Good morning and welcome to Central Standard Friday. I'm Monroe Dodd. Vietnam. The word signifies so much more than a country. To some baby boomers, particularly male baby boomers, it represents that scary place to which you might have been drafted to go as a soldier in the 1960s. To many Americans, Vietnam signifies an era that forever changed our country's view of the world and our people's views of one another. But in fact, few of us understand how that faraway land ever wound up etching itself in American history and memory. For that, there's today's guest, who's written a thorough and engrossing book about the roots of the war that gave its name to an era. Frederick Logevall is John S. Knight Professor of International Studies at Cornell University. His book is Embers of War, published this month by Random House. He joins us today from studios at Cornell. Fred, welcome to Central Standard Friday.
It's very good to be here.
Now, the war in that Southeast Asian country, the war that touched so many in Kansas City and across America in the 1960s, had its roots in centuries of colonial rule. What did big European powers want in the first place in that part of the world?
Well, I think in the case of the French, their motivations they had to do with geopolitical concerns. The British were already established in Southeast Asia. And the French, I think, felt that in order to keep up with the imperialistic Joneses, if I can put it that way, they had to have a toehold. They had to have a place in Southeast Asia. There was also an economic motivation, a belief on the part of business interests in France that you could have natural resources, that this was an area that was rich in them, and that they would help French businesses and the French people. And a sense, finally, I think, of a kind of missionary impulse. French missionaries had already been active for a long time in Indochina before imperial control. And I think there was also a sense on the part of religious leaders that this is a mission that we have, we, the French nation, have to bring civilization, to bring Christianity to the peoples of what we now call Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos.
And so France colonized this country in the 19th century.
Correct.
And you mentioned business and economic motives. If, for instance, you were in charge of the Michelin Rubber Company, you'd be very happy to have this place as a resource.
Oh, no question. I think, in fact, and there's been some very interesting scholarship done in the form of monographs and articles that I don't really have a chance to get into in the book, but that look at the efforts of Michelin in particular, as well as other companies, to establish themselves, but then also to get, and this is of critical importance, to get the Paris government to colonize, to in effect take control, because that's going to help the companies.
So with France as the current colonizer, because before France there had been China, with France as the current colonizer, as this 20th century dawns, you introduce what I take as the central character in your book, a well-educated, well-traveled, articulate, and urbane man named Ho Chi Minh. Can you tell us about him?
Well, he is an absolutely fascinating figure, and of course is I think well known to a lot of your listeners in terms of other books. But what I hope the book brings out is the degree to which he is so important from an early point. And, of course, a sub-theme in the book, if I can introduce that now, is his lifelong admiration for the United States. It's one of the tragic elements in the story that he believed, Ho believed for a long time, that the United States would be his ally in his cause. And one could say that ultimately he was kind of naive because he believed this, I think I show in the book, until the late 1940s. And maybe he should have abandoned the hope long before that. But the point is that he believed it. He was, as you indicated, an urbane, well-educated man who left Vietnam. One could say he fled Vietnam in 1911 or 1912, embarked on a period of travels, which included a stint in the United States, and then settled in France at the conclusion of World War I. And began then his, in a serious way, his quest to become the de facto leader of the Vietnamese nationalist movement. I don't try in the book to to romanticize him. Ultimately, I think it's a sympathetic portrayal of Ho, but he certainly made his share of mistakes. He and his Viet Minh lieutenants could be utterly ruthless in terms of dealing with domestic opponents, but no question that he is a key figure in this story.
Was Ho Chi Minh primarily a nationalist or primarily a communist, or is there an either-or question even existing there?
I think it's a false dichotomy. It's a question that, of course, historians and other authors have debated now for half a century, and the debate still goes on. And in fact, I've done a few other interviews for the book, and it's generally been, you know, it's come up. But I think it's a false dichotomy in the sense that I don't think for Ho Chi Minh, ultimately, there was a distinction. I think that he saw communism as the best path of development for his country. He came to see that that was the case. And I think he was a dedicated communist from the early 1920s. But it was always his country. And I think that's important to note. And I think if I had to choose, I would say he was a nationalist first. That was the conviction that he always had at the forefront of his mind, that he had to win independence for his country. He had to win freedom from his country, for his country. But I think I don't think he saw a dichotomy, and I'm not sure that we should see one either as observers.
But in 1960s America, the rather simplified view of him was that he was basically an agent of the Soviet Union.
Oh, no question. And in fact, I would go back further. In fact, in the book, we see that Dean Acheson, who was Secretary of State, as you know, under Truman, Acheson, who was himself a well-educated, sophisticated, cosmopolitan figure, Acheson frequently resorted to a very simplistic view of Ho that basically said all that matters is that he has communist convictions. He's probably a stooge, a tool of the Soviet Union and then later of communist China. And that was enough for American officials long before the 1960s.
Yeah, early in your book, you talk about how Ho, then still an admirer of America because of its moral standing and its mostly lack of colonizing the world, went to Paris in 1919 to try to speak to Woodrow Wilson after World War I.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, I couldn't resist opening the book with this story. It's a relatively well-known story, but it captures in many ways what is, again, a theme in the book, or several themes. As I said earlier, the degree to which he looked to the United States from a very early point, this country born out of an anti-colonial reaction, having had a president in Franklin Roosevelt who had, or would have a president, I should say, this is later, but would have a president in Franklin Roosevelt who was passionately anti-colonial. And at the same time, believing in 1919 that he had to get the attention of the great powers, including the United States, and that he had to make his pitch to them. And so he rents a top coat. He gets formally dressed. He prepares for this encounter that he hopes will happen. And, of course, it doesn't happen. The great leaders have no time for Ho Chi Minh. It's not clear that Woodrow Wilson ever even knew that Ho was there at Versailles. But it's an important symbolic moment.
You're listening to Central Standard Friday on KCUR. I'm Monroe Dodd. Today we're talking about Vietnam, a topic that has either dominated or been an undercurrent of American discourse for half a century and more. Our guest is Fred Loggeval of Cornell University, author of the just-released Embers of War, about the making of America's Vietnam. Now, before America got involved in it, Fred, when the French were still ruling, which French rule existed into the 1950s, they were ruling Indochina, which was in several parts. It wasn't just one Vietnam or even two. Would you describe that those regions?
Yeah, largely for administrative purposes, the French decided to divide Vietnam really into three entities, which was Cochin China in the south, and which is where most of the economic exploitation took place, which is where most of the French settlers lived. It was the kind of center of French activity, if you will. And then in the center of the country was Annam, and in the north was Tonkin. And most of the actual fighting in the war would take place in Tonkin in the north, because this is where the Viet Minh under Ho and under his military commander, Vo Nguyen Giap, this is where they established their base. This is where they had their control, and most of the fighting took place there. But that's how the French divided Vietnam. In addition, they also had Cambodia and Laos. So we can really speak of five parts of French Indochina.
Now, they had run the show since the late 19th century there in Indochina. But what events conspired to shake the foundations of French control?
Well, I think the two world wars are absolutely pivotal. They are the giant mountains on the landscape. I think even before World War I, you had the emergence, the slow emergence of a Vietnamese nationalist movement. And Ho Chi Minh, even at a young age, was a kind of peripheral, very peripheral figure in this. But I think the colonies played a very large role in World War I, not just for France, but for all the European powers. And people in the colonial world expected something in return for this massive sacrifice. They had given thousands of lives. They had fought on the front lines. They had heard Woodrow Wilson's message as enunciated in the 14 points. They had heard about the need for challenges to colonial control. And so World War I, even though nobody or very few people perceived it at the time, I think World War I shook the foundations of French colonial control to an important degree. Then in the interwar period, the agitation continues. The French are successful in crushing the resistance in Indochina in the interwar period. And then of absolutely monumental importance is World War II. And this is one reason why my book deals at considerable length in several chapters with World War II. I mentioned earlier that FDR and his opposition to a French return is very important. The degree to which the imperial system is really challenged in a very important way. And in particular in Indochina, I think what is revealed to a lot of Vietnamese is just how hollow the French control was. You'll remember that the French were defeated by the Nazis in 6 weeks in 1940, which is where my first chapter begins. Mm-hmm. That made an impression on the Vietnamese. And then the fact that the Japanese were able to so easily to swoop in to Southeast Asia, take control of much of Southeast Asia, that too showed again that the French, who had been perceived as omnipotent, or at least as tremendously powerful, well, maybe they weren't. Maybe we can, this being the Vietnamese, maybe we can, in fact, kick these Frenchmen and French women out. And so I think what more than anything else, it's the two wars that shake this foundation.
You quote one historian as saying that right after World War II, France controlled the southern part of Vietnam, but only within about 100 yards on either side of major roads.
Yeah. I think this is Bernard Fall, who's actually a really fascinating figure, mm-hmm. and who figures quite prominently in the book. And in fact, the book ends with Bernard Fall feeling gloom about American prospects in 1965. He was later killed while accompanying American troops on a mission near Hue in 1967. But he was referring to an early period when French troops seemed to have effective control. This was in Cochin China in the southern part of Vietnam. But if you ventured off the roads, as he was saying, if you went into the villages, you would see a very different picture. And it suggests, I think, and the book lays this out, how difficult it was for the French from a very early point to establish control. You needed a kind of saturation of manpower in the form of French troops that the French really could never muster. They were not able to send conscripts to Indochina. That was a non-starter in terms of domestic politics. You had to rely on foreign legionnaires, on volunteers, on colonial troops, on native troops, as they call them. And it caused problems from an early point.
Striking is how the situation for the French in Vietnam was much like the situation for the Americans a couple of decades later. The countryside simply wasn't in American control or South Vietnamese control during that whole era. The Viet Cong and others were out there. Now, Kansas Cityans typically point toward one of our number who became president of the United States, Harry Truman. Truman, mm-hmm. after World War II, who succeeded Roosevelt, faced a difficult world of difficult choices. What choices did he face and what path did he choose?
Well, he did face a difficult situation, and I'm glad you said that, because we should acknowledge and we should remember up front that when he becomes president in the spring of 1945, the Germans are basically defeated. The Japanese are on the ropes. In hindsight, we can certainly say that the game was up, but that was not something that was clear. It was certainly not guaranteed at the time that he took office. Moreover, even if the war itself was over, there was now a mammoth task of reconstruction. There was an emerging conflict with one of the allies, namely the Soviet Union. So Harry Truman had very big fish to fry, there's no question. And it stands to reason that Indochina and the question of who should control Indochina was not at the forefront of his mind or of his advisors' minds. That said, I do think it's important. The transition between Franklin Roosevelt and Harry Truman matters. And it matters because Franklin Roosevelt cared a lot about colonialism, worried that the imperial system had really been the cause of two world wars and one needed to end that system, that America needed to be on the right side of history, which meant supporting nationalist groups who clamored for independence. And in particular, as I suggested a moment ago, he had an aversion to French leader Charles de Gaulle, a personal one, but also an aversion to allowing the French to return to Indochina. Harry Truman did not. Harry Truman didn't have the same kind of interest in the colonial question. He didn't have the kind of interest or even knowledge, I think, about Indochina in particular. And so what happened under Truman, as I lay out, is the United States adopting a neutral position in this French Viet Minh war that is emerging. But it's a neutrality that always really tilts toward France. And I think that's important. But Truman, from an early point, therefore matters. And then, of course, as the book shows, as the French Indochina war deepens and develops, the United States becomes more and more committed to the French cause, despite its anti-colonial traditions. And Truman begins in 1950 to aid the French war effort substantially, which is an important moment in the story.
And it's parallel to the fighting in the Koreas, all part of the worldwide containment effort against communism.
Oh yeah, Korea, I think, is large on the landscape as well. In that, as you say, the war breaks out. This happens in June of 1950, and Indochina becomes now actually more important. One would think maybe that it would recede in importance because everything would be focused on Korea, but in fact, there is a feeling on the part of American planners that you need not only to prevail in Korea, but you need now even more to help the French to shore up that southern flank. You need to send a lot of material, a lot of weaponry to the French. And it becomes, as Americans like to say, and as French planners would say, you know, two fronts in the same war. And the French were very clever about reminding Americans that just as the Americans were leading the fight in Korea, so the French were fighting for the West in Indochina, and they were successful, I think, in making that pitch to the Americans, who were predisposed to hear it. But it had really important implications.
And the context of this domestically is that these from Harry Truman down, these are either elected or appointed officials who are very sensitive to the waves of American public opinion and politics, and anti-communism seemed to rule the day after World War II.
Oh, I think I found this part of the story so interesting to do, the degree to which, really for the French and the Americans, domestic political imperatives were absolutely crucial. I believe that for French strategists, it's not too much to say that after about 1949, they really ceased to believe that the outcome in Indochina mattered in a substantial way to French security. And why they persisted in the war for 5 years after that point really had much more to do with the domestic French politics, with their own careers, with their own personal advancement. And I think there are interesting similarities, by the way, there and the 1960s for American politicians. But so it mattered a lot in French domestic politics in that early period, but also, as you say, in American politics. We should remember that Mao Zedong's communist forces had prevailed in China in 1949. This was the so-called loss of China, blamed on Harry Truman, blamed on the Democrats. Republicans, I think, were very successful, really, for the next 20 years, 25 years, in portraying Democrats as soft on communism, as having allowed Mao to win, having allowed the Soviets to get the atomic bomb. This had to be blamed on somebody domestically. It had to be blamed on Democrats. And I think it had a kind of chilling effect on decision-making in the Truman White House. It also, I think, affected Eisenhower's decisions. He's a Republican, but Republicans, too, felt the need to show in a domestic political context that they were vigilant in opposing all communist expansion and that there would be a tremendous domestic price to pay if they were perceived as weak on this. So you're right. There's no question that domestic politics, that McCarthyism is important here.
And you also touched on one of the other major contexts of the era, I think, for any American, and that was the threat of thermonuclear war and the idea being we could all get blown away if these superpowers go at one another.
Oh, I think so. I think it's a kind of, how should I put it? It's an indirect part of my story, but I think it is a subtext that helps to shape how Americans and indeed how French politicians think about the stakes. In an interesting way, it also caused Allied governments, and here I'm thinking in particular of the French and the British, and I talk about this in the book. It caused them to get much more nervous than they might otherwise have been about a large-scale Western effort in Vietnam. As the French war effort begins to falter, and as the Americans become more and more anxious that the French might lose, there's talk about an international coalition that would go in and, in effect, save the French. And one of the things that concerns Winston Churchill in London is that this is going to be the beginning of World War III. And if you have World War III, then Britain will be a target of Soviet atomic weaponry, and it'll be the end of the British nation. So that atomic factor plays out, I think, in really interesting ways.
Yes, in the book you mentioned Churchill pointing out to someone that we are a very small, compact nation, and it
That's
wouldn't
right.
take many thermonuclear
no,
blasts.
No, I think he said a nuclear blast over East Anglia would be enough, I think is what he said.
Oh, we'll be back right after the break with Fred Logoval. You're listening to Central Standard Friday on KCUR. And welcome back to Central Standard Friday. I'm Monroe Dodd. We're talking about Vietnam and the trials suffered by the French colonizers and its American supporters. Those trials took place half a world away, but by the 1960s, they directly affected Kansas Cityans and the rest of the United States. Our guest is Fred Logoval, who's a professor of international studies and of history at Cornell University. He joins us from the studios at Cornell U. Next Thursday, September 6th, Frederick Logoval will be at the Central Branch of the Kansas City Public Library. He'll discuss his book, Embers of War, at 6:30 p.m. If you have a question about how Vietnam went from a faraway, little-thought-of land to the center of world attention, call us at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888, or email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. Fred Logoval, I mentioned there that in the one of the contexts after World War II and into the 1950s is that for most Americans, Vietnam was little known and little appreciated. Always there was some bigger issue out there in the world, wasn't there?
Well, I think that's right. I think that it was on the periphery of American foreign relations, and in terms of Americans' understanding of world affairs, one could say until the earlier mid 1960s, policymakers always understood that it was important, or that it should matter in terms of U.S. foreign policy. I think opinion makers, journalists, and others saw that the French War and the climax of that war had a great deal of potential import for the United States. And, you know, I begin the book by looking at a young congressman, John F. Kennedy's visit to Saigon, to Indochina in 1951. And Kennedy, who was planning a run for the Senate in 1952, and this was part of a kind of around-the-world tour to establish his foreign policy credentials, JFK, I think, understood even in 1951 that this little part of the world, from an American perspective, this faraway place, could have important implications for American foreign policy and, by extension, for his own political career. And it's one of the interesting parts in the story is to see Kennedy from 1951 for the next decade to 1961 when he assumes office as president, how his views on Indochina shifts and to what extent they remain constant. It's clear he understands from an early point that it's going to be hard for any Western power to prevail by military means in this neck of the woods. And yet, of course, he helps to escalate the war during his administration.
Now, in those 10 years, the Eisenhower administration comes closer than a lot of scholars have known or understood before, mm-hmm. to intervening with Americans in Vietnam in the 1950s.
Yeah, I think that Eisenhower and John Foster Dulles and their colleagues did come closer, particularly in the spring of 1954, as the French War is reaching its climax, as French troops in a small part of Tonkin in northern Vietnam called Dien Bien Phu are facing the prospect of a colossal military defeat, one of the great military encounters of modern times, which I detail in the book. This book is in part a military history. But as the French look to be on the ropes and close to defeat, Eisenhower and his team spent a lot of time deliberating in Washington about what to do. And I conclude in the book that they came closer to military intervention, at least with air power. And they lean very hard on the British in particular, because Congress has made clear, the Senate has made clear, and one of the senators in question is none other than Lyndon Johnson, has made clear that we only will do this, in effect, if the British are with us. And I think what I show, in a way that previous historians have at least underplayed, is just how hard Washington officials pressured the British to go along. When the British refused, Anthony Eden, Foreign Secretary, and Winston Churchill, when the British refused, they even tried to see if they could cobble together a military coalition without the British. That's how serious Eisenhower was.
In the middle 1950s, several of the great powers meet in Geneva, and it's finally decided that this is after the French have been defeated mm-hmm. at Dien Bien Phu, that this country ought to be split into two parts, right?
Yeah, and of course, the implications for the future are immense. The great powers basically decide, as you say, at Geneva. This is after the defeat at Dien Bien Phu. The conference has actually begun when Dien Bien Phu falls on May 7th, 1954. But it's at that conference in Geneva that eventually they reach an agreement. It looks like the conference is going to fall apart, in part because the Americans do not want to have an agreement that gives the communists any control of Indochina. Eventually there is an agreement. And the agreement is to divide the country into, at the 17th parallel, the Viet Minh, Ho and the Viet Minh make major concessions to allow this to happen, in part because they think it's going to be a temporary division. This is going to be a division that will last for 2 years. At that point, there will be elections for reunification. Ho is confident that he'll win those elections. American officials privately agree. I think every informed observer thinks that in all likelihood the Viet Minh will win because of the prestige that they've gained in defeating the French and in standing up for Vietnamese independence. And it has huge implications for the future because, of course, as we know, the division does not end in 1956. The elections do not take place. By then, the United States has made a commitment to the Saigon government under Ngo Dinh Diem, basically to bypass those elections to try to build up a non-communist South Vietnam. And so you have the division of the country with a communist North, a non-communist South, and the seeds are there for the second Indochina War.
I'll take a quick side venture here from our talk and go to Marvin in Prairie Village. Marvin, welcome to Central Standard Friday.
Hey there, guys. How you doing?
It's fine.
Good, thanks.
Hey, I am calling in just kind of as a perspective, I guess. My dad was shot down in January of 67 over North Vietnam, and I was about one and a half mm-hmm. when he got shot down. He was there for about 6.5 years in the Hanoi Hilton and some other prison camps and came home in 73. And then I got to go over there with a service organization in 2008 and 2009, the summers, and spent about 6 weeks each time when I was over there and got to visit the prison camp he was in or a couple of the camps he was in. And then also got to travel throughout northern Vietnam and went down towards Da Nang. And I guess I was struck, I mean, Vietnam has played a huge kind of psychological part of my growing up and who I am, and I think for a lot of Americans and folks here in Kansas City. And I was just struck by how much it's still fairly unknown and misunderstood as I was spending time in Da Nang and was going to the areas where the U.S. soldiers were camped and also trying to fight the Viet Cong, and then watching a Greg Norman golf course go up, and then the condos being sold on the beaches of Da Nang for, you know, $150,000. You can get a wonderful condo with the beaches, and the country is just changing so dramatically. And another thing is our group, many of us went over there, and there were a lot of younger teenage kids, and kind of went over there with a little bit of understanding of what happened, and some of us having shame of what we may or may not have done as a country, and take that for what it is. But the Vietnamese people, especially in the North, kind of like, what are you talking about? And I guess it hit me in that they, since they kind of came out on the victory side, they had moved on pretty much with their life and had come to a point of capitalism or entrepreneurship that I was just very surprised by. Of course, there's still the communist element there, and they're the have and the have-nots. But the people that I met had very much moved on, whereas it was still kind of churning inside of me when I went over there. And after the second summer of being there, I'd kind of come to somewhat of, you know, peace in terms of what had, my own trip, I guess. But, I guess I just am curious to hear your thoughts on modern Vietnam and where it's at and where we would have possibly wanted it to come to if we would have maybe won the war, because it seems very much in a healthy place from what I gathered, at least.
Well, it's a really interesting perspective that you have, and you're a little bit younger than I am, and I think that it's fair to say that, you know, those of us who don't have a direct memory of the fighting, and you probably have some because of your father's experience, but it's a little harder for us, as I think you suggested, than for those who came of age in the 60s. To really grasp the implications of this. And I think you're quite right about how Vietnamese today view this, because when I go over there, and I've been, needless to say, many times for this book and for previous work on the war, I too am struck by the degree to which the Vietnamese, and we should remember it's a young country, the degree to which the Vietnamese are keen to move on, and are, in my experience at least, very easy to deal with. It's still a communist government, a government that does not allow the kinds of freedoms that we demand and expect here. They have a long way to go. But on a interpersonal level, I quite agree with what you've said. It raises an interesting question. There's an implied question, I think, in your comment, which is, you know, to what extent can one say that the war was necessary to bring this about? And my own conclusion is that it was not. That there was an opportunity to have a kind of Titoist Vietnam, and that refers to the leader of Yugoslavia, who was a communist but who was also independent to a large extent of the Soviet Union. The United States could have, it seems to me, worked with Ho and his government, not probably been close allies, but you could have had an arrangement, and people perceived this at the time, which I think is critical. This is not just in hindsight. That would have spared Vietnamese and Americans all of the trauma and all of the bloodshed that followed.
Fred, you mentioned from time to time in your book the very first Americans to die in Vietnam, and they are some of the very first names listed on the Vietnam Wall in Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
And there's more than
1959.
And the names now total more than 58,000.
That's right.
So that's
And the first two, I close the narrative in the main chapter. There's an epilogue after that, but the main chapter ends with the deaths of Chester Ovnan and Dale Bice, who were killed in July of 1959. And their names are the first two names on the wall. Nobody knew at the time, obviously, that so many names would follow.
You mentioned a little bit in talking about JFK earlier, but it seems true of him and of Lyndon Johnson that they both found themselves in this thing, and some kind of inertia or momentum seemed to propel them forward without necessarily making sense.
I think that's right. I think I like the way you put that. On the one hand, this is a contingent story. I think that there were opportunities that were not taken, first by the French and then by the Americans, to end this thing before it really began. So there are alternatives. There's nothing inevitable about what happens. But I also think that one can overdo contingency. One can exaggerate it. And what I mean by that, and I think this goes to the point you're making, there were patterns of thought laid down in Washington in the late 1940s that remained remarkably constant for the next 20 years. U.S. officials in the Truman, Eisenhower, Kennedy, and Johnson administrations always had choices about which way to go. But when they were at that fork in the road, invariably they chose the path that led to deeper U.S. involvement. There is an inertia. I think it's easier for politicians, and this is not just on Vietnam, but this has contemporary connections. It's generally easier for politicians to stick with the current course, to hope for the best, to believe that maybe if we do a little bit more, all will turn out well, and that if we reverse course, having said publicly that this thing is really crucial to our national security, if we reverse course, we subject ourselves to possible criticism, to possible humiliation. We might lose political office. We might lose our job. You're right. There's an inertia that's there, and it has tragic consequences.
You're listening to Central Standard Friday on KCUR. I'm Monroe Dodd, here with Frederick Logevall, whose book Embers of War has just been published by Random House. And let's go to the phones once more to talk to Richard in Kansas City. Good morning, Richard.
Hi, guys. Great show. A little piece of trivia that I'm sure your author is very familiar with, but most people don't understand. My father was in CPAC Fleet Intelligence in the late 40s and 50s. He was actually in Vietnam in the late 40s as a uniformed Marine officer. But I think what would be of interest to the author is that he is the one who sat down with Vice President Nixon during the Dinh Binh Phu siege to talk about dropping an atomic bomb to break the siege. And I'm sure that's well known, but that's the closest we've ever come to dropping a nuclear bomb. And my dad was, he was not given to stories or telling long tales. He was a Marine for 35 years and great integrity, so I have no reason to suspect any reason for him to make that up.
Well, it's interesting.
Pearl at the time.
I'm really interested to hear this because Vice President Nixon is important both in 1953 when he goes for a visit to Indochina, and he is adamant that the United States and the French have to prevail militarily. And he's important in the spring of 1954, as you say, in being an advocate for military intervention by the United States. And I discuss in one of the chapters this plan, if you will, or at least this proposal that the United States make available to the French, two atomic bombs for use against Viet Minh positions around Dien Bien Phu. And there's great speculation among scholars about how did this offer actually, what, did the Americans make this offer to the French? Or was this something that the French misunderstood, given the differences in the languages, and some translator got something wrong? I leave the matter open, but what I do show, and I think is consistent with what you say about your father, is that the contingency planning for possible use of atomic bombs was serious. That at the middle levels, the United States officials in Washington, and this included your father, it seems, talked about how this would go, how one would do this, what would be involved, what would be the likely results. I might add that the French were aghast at this idea because they understood that if you dropped atomic bombs on Dien Bien Phu, not only would the Viet Minh be killed in large numbers, but so would the French Union forces. So who knows what could have been there, but I'm really interested to hear this about your dad.
Today, Fred Loggeval, the Vietnam era is recalled probably too narrowly, only for its much for its protests. The protests caused a political divide that you can argue continues right down to now. In 2005 in Kansas City, Jane Fonda was signing copies of her book when a Marine veteran of Vietnam put the book in front of her and then spat tobacco juice on her because of her activities in North Vietnam in the 60s. He later said he had no regrets. What is your – you are not of draft age and you were born in Sweden. What is your view from a slight remove of the American subtext of Vietnam even today?
Well, it's a really good question, and it's interesting. I'll tell a quick anecdote. I was in the LBJ library doing research for what became my first book. This would have been in about 1995. I had finished my PhD at Yale, and I was there doing research. And I got to know a fellow in the military, H.R. McMaster. He subsequently published a very important book called Dereliction of Duty. And H.R. said to me, Fred, do you realize we're part of this generation that can look at the Vietnam War not from such a personal perspective, and then we can look at this more objectively, that we can see this from a certain remove, and this will be good for scholarship. And I said, HR, you're right, by golly. And I think we both underestimated the degree to which even now, as you say, in 2012, this remains a very contentious issue. And I have respect for those who see this as, and see Jane Fonda and others as betraying the United States, as being unpatriotic. I don't agree with that perspective. But I think there's no question that this remains, for many Americans, still an open wound. It has been part of our presidential politics up through the last election. This might be the first one in 2012 in which it's not to the same degree. I don't know if this means it's the end of an era in that respect in terms of its role in American domestic political discourse. But you're quite right that that as recently as 2005, as you say, and indeed after that, there are sharp divisions on what the war meant for America, what defeat meant, and what it means for us today.
Let's go now to Ed in Kansas City, Kansas. Good morning, Ed.
Yeah, good morning. And I happen to be a Vietnam veteran of 1970 and 71. And just with what you were discussing just a second ago, one thing that it may rise to the level of an urban legend, but I recall being told at some point while I was there that in the Vietnamese language, to express the word peace in English, the Vietnamese language essentially would literally translate as no war. And I was very taken by that, that we're fighting a war in a country where even the language doesn't understand a state of peace. A state of peace only equates to we're not fighting anymore, and it kind of, like I say, I do not speak Vietnamese, so I can't I've never known if that was true or not, but I know it was a comment that was shared among the people that were there, the soldiers that were there and the Marines. And I just always found it intriguing that there can't possibly be much future in fighting in a culture where that is so basically ingrained in the culture, because that was the experience for modern Vietnam, for modern Vietnamese people, first under the French, of course, and then later with what became pretty much everybody.
Yeah, well, I think it's, and I think you point to something very important. It's a powerful point that you make, but it's worth remembering that most Vietnamese had not known, as you say, had not known peace in their lives. And I think a lot of Vietnamese, a majority of Vietnamese, I would venture to say, had no particular attachment to either side in the struggle, either to the Viet Minh and later the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese government, or to the South Vietnamese government. And what they wanted was for the fighting to end. Maybe they didn't have a conception of peace, as you put it, in a certain way. But the amount of fighting that had taken place, first to some extent during World War II and the Japanese occupation, and then forever for several decades thereafter, of course, is going to have a profound impact on how ordinary people in the countryside and in the cities perceive the world around them.
Ed, thanks very much. Now, Fred Logavall, my own memory of the era was first all about the draft. Then came the thought that fighting and dying for your country was a noble pursuit, and Americans before you had done it, and you had to go do it. But then came, of course, a counter thought. What if you and tens of thousands of others this time were fighting and dying to no purpose? That whole matter of the draft in America, in my own humble opinion, propelled a lot of the dissent of the 1960s. And lives with us still today.
Oh, sure, and I think one cannot understand the domestic context of the war, as you say, in the mid and late 1960s, without reference to the draft. And for a generation, for your generation, for a generation of college students, and especially men, I think it had tremendous impact. And when the draft ended, it's no coincidence that the nature of the protests in the United States changed. I'm not sure that attitudes about the war changed, but there's no question that what you see in terms of agitation after that point under Nixon is very different from what you had seen before. And it also helps to explain, obviously, the responses to the Iraq War more recently in Afghanistan. The draft is crucial as we think about something that's in some ways outside the scope of my book, except to some extent in the epilogue. But as we think about what the Vietnamese refer to as the American War, it's right there.
Well, let's go now to Rusty in Ozaukee, Kansas. Good morning, Rusty.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes.
I just wanted to say, and I was drafted in 1966 and got out in 68, and my sense of the whole protest thing was it's been misunderstood. People were not protesting against those of us who were drafted and in the Army fighting. They were protesting against the idea that the only reason we were there was to make money for the bomb makers. And I think that essentially a whole bunch of us that were in the service felt exactly that same way. The only reason we were here was to make profit for Raytheon and other big companies. So there's my comment, and I'd like you to maybe elucidate on that a little bit.
Well, I think it's a valuable point, and I think that is how a great many protesters felt. I think it's probably how a great many of those who were opposed to the Iraq invasion and to the subsequent war also felt. It was not a criticism of individual soldiers by any means. It was a criticism of decision makers. I don't think in the case of Vietnam or later in Iraq and Afghanistan, it was necessarily focused just on shall we say, business interests. I think that many of those who opposed the war in Vietnam also opposed the argument that the domino theory held, that this piece of real estate in Southeast Asia was of critical importance to American national security. And I think there were some who suggested that, you know, the Democrats in particular, that Johnson and before him Kennedy, are doing this mostly for domestic political reasons. They're doing this because they're concerned about what the implications will be if they do not stand firm in Vietnam. So it wasn't just about Raytheon and about McDonnell Douglas and, you know, other corporations, I think, in the minds of some. But the thrust of your point, I think, is spot on.
Sadly, that's all the time we have for today's show. We've been discussing the road to America's intervention in Vietnam, a road that was fraught with difficulty for Kansas City and the country. Our guest has been Frederick Loegewal, author of Embers of War, which was published this month by Random House. Thanks so much, Fred Loegewal.
Thank you for having me.
Now, Frederick will speak next Thursday at the Central Branch of the Kansas City Public Library at 10th and Baltimore downtown. The event begins at 6:30 p.m. For more information on our guests and upcoming shows, visit our website, kcur.org. Our show is produced by Andrea Salenzi with help from Tamika Witherspoon. Our announcer is Kim Noble. I'm Monroe Dodd. Tune into Central Standard Friday next week for the Food Critics, and enjoy your day.